Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Josh, you know what?
Go on.
I prefer January 2024's releases. It's already better than everything in 2023.
What?
It's incredible.
What do you mean?
I got Power World. I got Prince of Persia.
Power World?
Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth. I'm absolutely loving Tekken 8. I can't stop playing it. I prefer all four of those games to anything that came out last year.
That's outrageous. Yeah, that is actually crazy.
Say it with my full chest.
Power World. You're the ones I get. Power World you can't throw
Power World's phenomenal, mate. What are you talking about?
Phenomenal.
I made a little bar. There's a little bar, a little tab, a little hot tub. All the little pals are in the hot tub, mate.
I don't know. Do that in real life.
If I can afford to put all of my pals in a little hot tub and a bar combo, I would.
Well, here's the thing, man. I'm never going to play Power World.
I love
that people like it, but I'm not playing something just because it's gone viral. I don't like survival games.
I'm not saying you play just because it's viral.
I don't even like Pokemon, man.
You can shoot them.
I don't want to shoot them.
Take a club to them.
The one delicious part of Pokemon is being able to be lovely to those little guys.
You can do that too. We did a little news, little discussion thing on it last week because the game unintentionally or potentially intentionally taps into workers' rights and dictatorial regimes and capitalism and ways that you treat a workforce, etc. I'm treating all my pals very well. I'm only killing the ones that I have to for the sake of getting some lamb chops out of them. But for the most part, they're all treated very well. They've got beds, they've got a little tavern. Loving it.
That's unsurprising because as a manager, you also treat your pals quite well in real life. So that I'm pleased that translates. I'm pleased you're not like doing a sort of double life thing where in real life you're really nice and cuddly, but in the fictional world, Scott, manager and pal world is shooting his workers and he's not being very nice to them at all.
Well, that was the thing. I you can't tell how intentionally or unintentionally this stuff is because the CEO himself, and I will get off pal world in a sec, but like the CEO himself said he has no creative vision for this. And it's like, but you are tapping into this stuff. You are giving agency to millions of players to see what kind of boss they might be. And I think the results from that are kind of fascinating. Some people have been sharing footage of like, you know, just hanging various pals. You can hang humans in the world as well, but you can be an absolute monster if you want to be, or you can just be very nice and pay for the food and give them little hot tubs.
This is the most out of touch I've ever felt like in my entire life. Like, I feel like I'm at the age now where
I'm older than you as well.
No, I know, but sometimes things pass you by, right? Yeah. And you're aware of them. You know what they are. You know why people are into it. This is the first time where I wasn't aware of it. It became an overnight sensation.
Yeah.
And even now, like, I've watched a few gameplay videos, but I just can't get it. And that's fine. It's not for me. I love that people are having fun,
but it's
given me a bit of an existential crisis, I think. Why can't I at least understand?
Well, you got to play it, haven't you? It's right there.
No, I didn't have to play Fortnite, though, to understand why people love that.
No, but that wasn't as confusing as to why it's taken off. This has got all these weird animal abuse things going on, but then it's all for the greater good.
With this one, I get it. Survival games are huge. Pokemon are huge. You mesh those things together, David Brent style, and you've got a gangbusters video game.
That's how it's working.
I think it's survival games in general. Again, to get off Power World soon. all of those, like, especially the PC-based sensations, like, is it Sons of the Forest and Ark Survival Evolved and all of that? Like, those games that, if we're talking about my biggest blind spots, those are right. I don't know. I know why they're huge.
Right.
I just Because usually I don't have access to them. I just don't have the reference point for any of them.
Did you ever play Minecraft?
No.
Really? Not at all?
Don't have an imagination.
You do.
I don't, man.
You can just survive.
The idea of playing Minecraft.
Imagination. What do you mean? I don't think me. It's whatever's in front of me.
No,
that's it.
I'd like, when I used to play The Sims, man, it used to drive me nuts. Like, I just can't think in that way for whatever reason.
So the game stimulates you. You don't need to have everything.
When Minecraft, it's like the Zelda. It's the Zelda conundrum. It's the Tears of the Kingdom conundrum where I've got this sandbox full of possibilities. Right. I can build anything in the world. And all my brain says is stick a few wheels on that plank of wood and then just go. That's as far as I get. I can't build these lush contraptions or these lush Minecraft worlds or recreations of beloved historical monuments.
Only like five people can do that stuff.
But then at the same time. You know what it is. Getting to the core of it. I bought a guitar when I was 13. Right. Well, I didn't buy it. You know, I didn't have money to buy it. My dad bought me a guitar when I was 13. And it was all I wanted for like 5 years. I just wanted to get a guitar. I wanted to learn guitar. Mm. And when I wasn't good at it in 2 weeks, I just never touched it again.
Yeah.
And I think it's a similar thing where when it comes to something like Minecraft, because I can't be good at it instantly and because I can't create the things that I want to create, similar to Animal Crossing, and because I have to put in the graft and I have to learn the mechanics, I don't get that instant gratification, so my mind just puts it down.
These games are a lot more instantaneous than you might have given them credit for, especially Power World. That game is popping off left, right, and center. The unlocks in Power World are so good and so meaningful and so immediate. That's why it's so easy to get completely lost.
Admittedly, I've only watched the video game Donkey.
He did it
review
wrong.
Of it, but he was the way he, and I know it's comedic, but the way he presented that game of having to do, again, the graph to get to the quote unquote good bits and put time in mining things and getting your resources, that put me off Animal Crossing. You know, I really wanted to get into that when the whole world was playing it, when we were all indoors, and I watched my girlfriend play 200 hours of it. But when I tried it, I had the same thing that I had with Minecraft, where I thought, why can't I just have why can't I put a cheat code in like I can in The Sims?
No, you're not wrong. I think like that's the thing in Tears of the Kingdom made me want to have like a build mode. Just let me do cool stuff rather than have to go grind out, you know, to hack down 50 logs, 50 trees to get enough wood to get the blah, 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 that's horrible. No, I think there are bits of that in Power World, but then you just put them to work. You just make a little forest and they just live in the little forest and they just bring you the wood and they go mining and they bring you the rock and the way they carry it's really cute.
There's something about, I can't hold the information in my brain. That's the issue. It used to happen with RTS games as well. You know, those games where you build your civilizations, you start from scratch. When we played Valiant, and when we were doing that, I really enjoyed my time with that game, genuinely, even though it was an ad. Enjoyed playing it with you, but it was another thing of, I realized if I was playing this for 100 hours, I couldn't keep it in my brain because I get to a certain point where it scales up and you're having to juggle all of these systems. I know Power World is much more streamlined than one of those big RTSs, but I find it a bit overwhelming with the numbers and the resources. I've always wanted to play a game called Frostpunk, which is supposed to be like incredible and tap into some pretty complex themes, but maybe that's the next genre I crack. I've cracked turn-based games with Baldur's Gate, which is a true turn-based game, and you don't need any. It's the peak of the genre.
Turn-based Final Fantasy, no, keep it away from me.
Nah, keep that away from me.
I've got Baldur's Gate, mate.
Yeah, Baldur's Gate, let me do some jumps.
Doing my part.
So maybe this is the next genre. Maybe Power World is my in, who knows? It probably won't be.
Oh my God, I would love you to just come in one day and be like, I've played Power World. That conversation would make my life. I just want to know your thoughts on the entire thing. Anyway, we're going to do a whole release calendar for everything that's coming out in February. We'll break down all the main games, and we'll get to that in a little bit. I do want to tell you, tell your face.
Just want to say this is the wind-up, by the way.
Yeah, we've been talking like 20 minutes. This is the wind-up. I'm Scott Tilford. That's Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Tackling the latest video games, the latest video game conversations, anything else going on in the industry, which is to say we're about to end January and go into another stacked month next month. But we'll get there. Tekken 8 is phenomenal.
I said the
crazy hype thing before because Tekken 8 is the best thing
I'm so
around.
Pleased to hear this because last week, not to get you in the doghouse with our listeners. But you were saying, you know, you were obviously looking forward to Tekken 8.
I'll be very honest about it, yeah.
But you were saying, you know, it just looks like more Tekken. And then when the reviews dropped, I was ravenous for it to see you completely won over as well. I can't wait until we get paid so I can buy Tekken 8.
I was a fool to myself. The thing is with Tekken, I've been there since the very beginning. Yeah. I came in on Tekken 3 and then I bought Tekken 1 and 2 to catch up, and I've been with it ever since. I adore Tekken. It's one of my favorite franchises. But because of that, when you're with something that much and you play them that much, I only re-downloaded Tekken 7 like last year to play just a few matches of it and mop up some of the DLC that was on sale. I think for me, you end up taking bits of it for granted. And Tekken 7 to me didn't really blow me away. Mm. I like the story stuff. And I like the idea of the mechanics they were bringing in from Street Fighter, the idea of the rage jots and the finishers and stuff. They're cool. But anyone who's played Tekken 7 will know that the way that those finishers went, they were just ostensibly a stitching together of moves your character already had in a row. They looked really terrible, to be honest, from my point of view. And so Tekken 8, I was just like, I'm not getting my hopes up again, because I did for 7. And there was that really big gap in between Tekken 6 and Tekken 7.
Yeah.
I'm just going to wait and see. And I wasn't keeping up with the trailers other than Kazuya versus Jin. And I played the demo and I was like, I'm just going to wait. Like, I'm just going to wait and see. And then when you play it, it is the best Tekken that we've had since like 3 or 5.
So what's made it this must-play sort of I can't stop playing this game phenomenon for you? Is it literally just the way it plays? Is it like, because I was watching some reviews of it trying to get hyped, and they were talking about like the story mode, the arcade modes they've got in there, the online play, and it all looks robust. In fact, it reminded me a lot of Street Fighter VI's suite. So like, what is it about it? Is it literally just the game feel, or is it the package?
It's both. Like, it's a really, really robust package, where you do have a really cool cinematic story that doesn't actually have that many fights in it versus the cutscene ratio. I only just started the story last night. I've just been playing online and been playing the arcade mode. So yeah, you have the story side of things. You have the arcade mode where you make like a little chibi, looks like a Pokemon version of yourself.
Yeah, like an Xbox avatar, I thought.
Totally. And then it's like that story is about someone trying to get into Tekken. And so like, which is great. It really, really works, because a whole thing, and you had this across Street Fighter 6, MK1, Mortal Kombat 1, and then Tekken. For whatever reason, there's a wave of people looking to get into fighting games right now. And Tekken 6 Tekken 6, Street Fighter 6, and now Tekken 8 have some of the best onboarding tutorials. In this case, you can save replays and then break it down. It'll give you annotations and be like, oh, if you did this move here, they would have done this. And this is what this terminology means and everything else. Frame data, whatever. You can go as deep as you want or keep it as casual as you want. There's a whole new control scheme for people coming in that just gives you a 4-button control scheme in terms of just hit this button 3 times and you'll do an auto combo. Auto combos have been in there for a while, but they've done it better here if you're playing that way, in terms of giving you better access to low attacks, launchers, aerial moves. If you just want to look cool for a bit, you can just put that on. At the beginning, until you disable it, it's just on L1 or LB. You just push a button to switch control schemes on the fly. So whenever you're ready, you just go to the proper control scheme.
Cool.
It's phenomenal. Really, really well done. I turn all that stuff off. Obviously, I'm a legacy player or a veteran player. But you have that side of it. You have the arcade mode, which is really, really cool, with your little chibi self and how cute that is. And you're unlocking parts for your characters and stuff. But the meat of it is just how much they've refined it. Like, the one of these things where you play a fighting game for this long, every time you play one, it's okay, what moves have they kept in? What cheesy moves have they refined? What animations have been changed? Everyone plays better than they ever have before. Someone like Jin, who's like my main, I love Jin, I love Hwarang, I love the whole roster, to be honest, but I love Jin. They've overhauled him in terms of the way you can string lots of moves together. So you immediately become more comfortable with what chains into what. But an overarching side of it is that you have the rage arts, which is when you're on low enough health, you can do a big move that is like a big finisher thing. It can be a finisher, but it'll also reduce someone's health all the way down to pretty much what you are on. Mm. So you have like this last clinch move to get back out of your just about to be beaten if you can land it. There's a window in there where the opponent can still finish you off if they're quick enough. So you have the rage arts. They were in there in Tekken 7. The cool thing is that they've also added a heat meter in this, and you get that once per round where you can flick a heat thing on, which means that you can then have access to a heat combo, which is like usually like a 4, 5, 6 combo thing that does a lot of damage. But when you're in the heat state, you also do chip damage, which means you punch through someone's block.
Yeah.
So if you know you want to put your heat meter on and just go for it when you're in that state, it only lasts for about 10 seconds, if that. But it's an excuse to go all out, and it's only once per round. So it's like, cool. do you want to save that for the last fight, or do you want to do that straight away? Do you want to go all out in the beginning or save it? And it's just all that stuff. And there's so much more. Like, fighting games are chess games at this point,
right?
But,
yeah.
In terms of rock paper scissors games, rather. But they just nail the whole thing. It just plays so well.
I don't know if this is a big change. I don't even know if it is a change coming off the previous games, as I only played Tekken 7 for about half an hour after buying it. What a waste of money that was, even though the game was probably good, just got to it too late. I know that they've changed the health to a for lack of a better term, this probably isn't the first fighting game to do it, but a Blood Bond system.
I knew you were going to say Blood Bond, yeah.
Where you can obviously get a little bit of health back if you are aggressive, but obviously only a little bit.
Yep.
Does that change things much, or is it just a nice little addition?
I'll tell you what, in terms of health bars, they've really sped up the fights themselves, like the amount of damage that a character does. It's been a thing where Tekken fans will know what I'm talking about, where like the generations of Tekken over the years, they've leaned more into aerials. Like aerial combos were always a thing, to a point, but like Tekken 6 onwards, I'm going to go with 6 onwards, was when they really started saying, hey, look, if you can get someone up in the air, that's when you maximize damage.
Yeah.
And then it was like different things where different patches would change how much damage you would do in the air. Some characters had just cheesable moves that would keep you up in there forever, and it always felt horrible being stuck in the air, as it does in every fighting game. And obviously things like Mortal Kombat give you a button to get out of it. Tekken doesn't. If you nail a launcher, then that's your open window.
Right.
And so in regards to health, you are decimating people. Like, fights last like 15 seconds or something. That's why the heat thing.
That's crazy. Like, that is crazy.
If it's too good, if they're really going for it. Like, yeah. I mean, you can hang back and everything, but you're very much encouraged to dive in. And it is that really quick back and forth thing of just lots of exchanges of highs, lows, different length attacks and different modes that you're putting your character into, and then triggering a rage art and inverting it at the last minute and things like that. So yeah, in regards to the health, if you, like you said, go on the offensive, you can get some stuff back. To me, it hasn't been reclaiming enough health where it's made that much difference. It's like reassuring to know that coming out of a special move, you've got a little bit more health for the rest of it.
Yeah.
But I find that the overall amount that they've upped the damage, you're just getting wiped out anyway, or you're wiping them
really
out anyway.
Really interesting that. You know, it's an entirely personal thing, I suppose, but when I used to play fighting games more regularly, I loved the games that allowed me to, you know, buff those health bars up so you had like four screens before you died. I remember playing the old Dragon Ball Z Budokai games, and you could add like 10 layers of your health bar, so you could have these really long, drawn-out fights. So that's interesting, but do you think that pace and the speed of those fights, like, work in the game's favor?
It massively does to me. I think, yeah, because it's like, just one more, give me one more. Like, someone just beat me, I'll go again. Like, the online multiplayer is, like, ruthless. Like, even if you're going off the casual matches or the unranked stuff, this would potentially be a detriment, and it's on the game to, you know, mediate this based on who you get matched with. But you're, like, the average level of Tekken players online, I mean, it's fighting games online, it's a meme.
Yeah.
But, like, most people are absolutely ravaging you, unless you know most of how to come back.
Yeah.
And maybe it's always the case with any fighting game roster where there's always that one character or a handful of characters that get favored online because they can do some sort of move that can be spammed. And nothing like that has emerged just yet in Tekken. So even out for the weekend. But there is that side of it where you're venturing online and you're getting into these ruthless fights where you just, it's the same thing that we kind of remember from when you played fighting games as a kid, where you play against someone who's, oh, just give us a match and I've been playing. I remember ProZD did a skit on it where it's just sort of, you play one match, you get annihilated, and then you're just like, well, what was I even supposed to do?
Yeah.
And Tekken 8 is very much addressing that what you're supposed to do thing. But yeah, I absolutely love the pace. Like, the whole presentation, the music is unbelievable.
Tekken's always that great music,
oh,
hasn't
dude.
It?
Like, they got the dude back, is it Masayoshi Soken? No, that's the guy that did Final Fantasy 16. The dude's surname is Sano, I forget what the first name is, but the guy that did Tekken 3, he's back for like one song in this, and you can tell. Like, it's, I was playing it for you a little bit before, I was like, it's such a beat to it. But the whole thing, the whole package, it's just this great, like, the best of, like, Japanese techno, which is like the whole thing that I love anyway. Like, give me Sega music, give me Namco music. It's just such a package. And you put the headphones on, and like the sound design is just exquisite. Like, I cannot sing this thing's praises enough. Like,
that's
I
great,
do prefer
man.
It to anything from last year.
Really?
Like, oh, dude, it's already my game of the year. Like,
even better than, I know I keep going back to Street Fighter 6, but that really felt like it set the bar for fighting games going forward. That thing was beloved. Like you said, it introduced all of those new features and helped onboard new fans. Is this
to me,
above, or is it just like a franchise?
It's going to be a preference thing. Yeah, I think they're right alongside each other. Like,
cool.
This is the new wave of what the new generation of fighting games should feel like. Like, whether you're a newcomer or a veteran, like, they're catering to both sides perfectly. Yeah, I think it's a preference thing. I prefer Tekken, like, to Street Fighter. And it's not splitting hairs. I am more of a Tekken fan, so it is that. Growing up with both, but it's definitely a Tekken thing. But I just, the feel of it as a package, no part of it feels like it's taking advantage of you. If you feel respected as a player.
That's
and you shouldn't necessarily have to point that out.
No.
But in this industry, like, it's worth saying that. And you're getting so much stuff. And they've already said, you know, they're doing a season pass of like four characters or something. And Eddie Gordo has already mentioned as one of them. And so they do have all this seasonal content planned, and you feel quite catered to. And it's just, as a veteran franchise, eight installments in, to be this strong, like stronger than ever. Like, this is a Tekken 5 level thing. Like, 3 and 5 are the top two. And this is way up there immediately. You can feel it. Like, it's great.
I like that you mentioned the online play, because part of the reason why I dropped off fighting games was that pivot to online bouts. As someone with a nervous disposition, I just found them way too intimidating.
Oh, it's anxiety AF, man.
Imposing. Like, yeah. So I've kind of avoided a lot of fighting games over the past, 10 years? You know, I've mostly only played Mortal Kombat games. And in terms of where I'm at with Tekken, I have owned a Tekken because I bought Tekken 7. But last time I put some substantial amount of time into an installment was Tekken 4. Like, right. I didn't play Tekken 5, had a few games of Tekken 6. Like I said, got Tekken 7 for about half an hour, but it was like 6 years after it released. I just wanted to play as Negan from The Walking Dead, did that, and then kind of moved on. In the feel of it was, even though I hadn't played it in so long, was so familiar, I just went back to Mortal Kombat 11 because I thought, well, I've played as some of these characters before. I already know the combos that I'm going to do, even from only playing the game previously, hammering Tekken 4 and Tekken 3 and a bit of Tekken 2. So this being so strong and this having those onboarding features that you mentioned, this is the first time in years where me as a sort of lapsed fan, if you could say that, really feels like I need to play this game. I never felt like I needed to play Tekken 6 or needed to play Tekken 7, but this feels like Street Fighter 6 and like Mortal Kombat 11, like the franchise is back.
Yeah, man. Well, it's funny you mentioned MK, because I feel like Mortal Kombat 1 has, like, fell off.
Yeah.
Like, the way that game was over-monetized, the skin packs they've sold, the way that they've treated the fans. Like, as a huge Mortal Kombat fan, I've just dropped off that game. Like, it doesn't... Like I said, you don't feel respected as a player, you don't feel catered to in the way that Street Fighter 6 and Tekken 8 have done. But it's true, like, yeah, as a package, it is just so strong. And for whatever reason, like, I've got various friends that have said, like, I'm going to get back into Tekken. And I'm like, what is it about this game? But it's so good that they're capitalizing on it. You mentioned Tekken 4, and I want to throw in the fact that Tekken 8 brings back Tekken 7's thing, where you can go in the jukebox and just set a previous game's sound design as your overall thing. Incredible. You can also design you can customize them. So if you want the menu theme from Tekken Tag, and then, like, the stage from Tekken 4, or the character select screen from Tekken 5, you can do all that stuff. It was in 7, but it's just so good.
Hey, I'll actually tell you what got me most interested. Tekken Ball's back.
Tekken Ball's back.
I love Tekken Ball. Tekken Ball was so good. Tekken Ball's back. Get Mortal Kombat Chess back. Get all of those mini games back in these fighting games, and I'll be back on board.
Yeah, we keep saying, and no one's ever listened to this, and I've talked to Ed Boon, but I didn't actually ask him this thing, but why don't they just do a Mortal Kombat spin-off collection? Put Mortal Kart or whatever it was called in there, Kart Combat.
Come on.
I would love it. Yeah, it's worth saying, Tekken Ball is just unlocked from the start. There's no DLC price, and which they learned from. Tekken 7, they were charging for frame data, and they charged for Tekken Ball. But in this one, it's like a strong enough foot forward. But yeah, I cannot sing its praises enough. I played it all weekend. I literally couldn't get off it. Like, because every time I would... I knew I needed to play Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth. I love that series as well. I've been growing up with that thing too. But every time I thought about just not playing Tekken, I was like, but then I wouldn't be playing Tekken. Yeah. So I'll just keep playing Tekken. And then it wasn't until, like, I don't know, 1 a.m. last night that I finally started a bit of Infinite Wealth. And I was like, I'll do some of that. But oh my God, man. Like, Tekken is back. And it never really left, because the seasons of Tekken 8, 7, Tekken 7 lasted so long, but this is so strong. Like, it's, oh dude, it's the best.
Tekken is back, man. What a great thing to announce. You know what, man, once we get paid, I'm gonna get it, because I felt like Bart Simpson, you know, when he gets what's his face's putting challenge instead of Bone Storm,
Lee Carvello's putting challenge.
I kept seeing adverts for Tekken 8 all weekend, and I'm having a lovely time playing Baldur's Gate 3 still. I'm 100 hours in. I'm probably nearing
you're
the
hopefully
end
hopefully near the end
but
of
it, it did feel like I was playing Lee Carvello's putting challenge, because I thought, look at this cool thing over there, look at the Bone Storm or whatever it is.
Yeah, it is like the Bone Storm of 2024. But yeah, you're playing, time to dive in. I wanted to just super quickly say that Prince of Persia is still incredible. I'm at the very end of that game. I don't want that game being overlooked, because it's just, it is buried underneath Power World, underneath Tekken 8, underneath Infinite Wealth, in regards to the amount of marketing that went behind it. I did see Ubisoft say thanks for all the positive reception, and it seems to be selling well, although I've not really checked in on it. But it's just, if you like Metroidvanias, you like Hollow Knight, you like 2D platformers, 2D action platformers, it's an immaculate one. It's the best one since Metroid Dread, like, hands down. It's just phenomenal. Let's talk about February and every single thing coming out in February. the first thing down. I don't know why I'm laughing so much. Maybe it's going to be incredible. Suicide Squad. February 2nd, my friend.
God, I really hope the codes come through for that game. Yeah. Genuinely, right? Everyone's slagging it off. Everyone, rightfully so, is pointing out how repetitive the gameplay looks. Yeah. But there's something about those cutscenes. There's something about the potential of the story, and I've mentioned this before, that is just, to me, if they can't botch it. Like, surely, in terms of story, in terms of character, in terms of the scope of what they built from that side of things, like, this is still Rocksteady. They might have changed their gameplay approach. They might have had to make some caveats to Warner Brothers, who knows, but they are great at presentation. They are great at presenting a story, and I know Arkham Knight's narrative is, of course, divisive. I happen to still really love it in the swings they took, especially towards the end with some of the first-person dream-like levels that you get. And if there's anything like that in here, it will be worth playing. I just don't think, and maybe we'll disagree on this, that it's going to be a Gotham Knights situation where, to me, that was so mid. Like, the story was mid, the combat was mid, the world was mid. I think that even if the... I think if even the combat in world is a little bit empty in Suicide Squad, I hope, and maybe I'm being naive, that story will make it worth experiencing.
If they can pull off an actual story with a fundamentally co-op-based gameplay model, that'll be a world first.
Yeah.
So maybe. If anyone can do it, it's Rocksteady. They came out of nowhere and did Arkham Asylum. I just don't have any faith in it. However, it's a curio. I'm very curious about what they've done after this long and for how long it's been in development. But everything's stacked against it. Like, it's just, they haven't even been doing review codes, which you can argue is because they need a live environment for all the servers and everything. But they did do a beta, so there is a previous version out there to get hands on. Obviously, the response on the critical side was very, very negative, and we haven't had access to it at all. Probably for good reason, considering the amount of videos that we've done on it, which is fair enough. But now that we're this close to the review period, the launch period, it just feels like it's a dead game walking. And I'm curious if that actually does permeate the social media conversations, the online conversations, the gamer conversations, permeates through to the mainstream. Do you have those casual friends that are looking forward to it? Is it more of a thing where it takes off anyway?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. And it's like, I want Rocksteady to be okay.
Yeah.
Like, I feel sorry for them genuinely in regards to the way that the development of this is rumored to have gone, where they were given Suicide Squad when WB Montreal had a version of it in the works. It was given to Rocksteady. I'd love clarification on that, if anyone else can provide it. But it feels like they were then given it to get this over the finish line, and almost like a Warner Brothers style thing where the overarching corpo side of it was like, Suicide Squad's our thing, we're doing the movie, we're going to have the game, get this stuff done. And it was never their bread and butter. And you saw so many staff leave, including the founders of Rocksteady.
Yeah.
And so I just want this out the way so they can do something else.
Well, here's the worry. We're going to talk more about this on the Wednesday podcast that goes out. But there was a recent report from Variety that was looking into the W Games division and how that is being more incorporated within the larger framework of Warner Brothers. Like, James Gunn is going to have more direct oversight over the DC slate of games, and they're looking to essentially just monetize their portfolio more. They said they're doubling down on live service games.
Yeah.
They're going all out on player retention, so we don't just, as in their words, literally pay for a blockbuster once every 3 or 4 years. They're going to find ways to keep these games alive through live services. So when you talk there about, you know, you just kind of want Rocksteady to be able to get this out of the way and move on to a Rocksteady game, I don't even know if that's going to be in the future. And it's a shame because, you know, I don't want to speak for any of the developers, don't know any of the developers. But yeah, you have to assume this isn't necessarily the direction they wanted to take, at least from a gameplay perspective. Story-wise, it might be exactly what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that overall mandate, you can just feel it creeping in. You know, you mentioned Mortal Kombat 1 before and that being over-monetized. That's another WB game. They've made these mistakes in the past with Middle-Earth, Shadow of War. Yep. A promising franchise, which killed it dead, you know? So it just, it's not the right approach. But with Suicide Squad, I hope, beyond hope, that it is good, that it is worth playing, that it has something there, that Rocksteady spark, that Rocksteady soul. Maybe that, like I said, maybe that's naive because it seems like everyone has just turned on it.
True. It is worth saying that, like, obviously the hands-on stuff, our own Ewan Paterson played it as well and did confirm, like, the cutscenes, the character writing, it is very, very funny. It's very tightly written, like, the actual characterization. Samoa Joe's King Shark, for God's sake. Like, that stuff's great. It's just the way that it plays, and that's the stuff that is the most directly influenced by the corporate side of it. How much do we monetize this stuff? And, yeah, like, you think back on how awesome, I was going to say the one that was before Shadow of War, the Shadow of Mordor.
Yes.
How awesome that was, how well received that was, arguably Game of the Year 2014. And then you had Shadow of War, which had great mechanics, but it had everything else around it that brought it down, and it killed it. We haven't had a Middle-earth game since then, which is such a shame because that game plays so uniquely, the framework of it is so unique. And then I would argue that MK1 has been massively impacted by how aggressive that monetization is. And it's just the WB effect. Like, they just seem to drill everything into the ground.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, it's going to take more seismic mess-ups before the people at the top realize. Like, there was that whole thing when Zaslav first mentioned that they want to do more games as a service type stuff. And it was just people pointing out the amount of them that have failed, including the Avengers, which will be a direct analog to a multiplayer superhero loot thing.
Again, don't want to cannibalize our own podcast, but I think it's fascinating that, yeah, Zaslav is out there saying we want more live service games, but at the same time saying James Gunn's going to have more oversight and these games are going to be canon. Like, I don't know if you want to do live service games as canon, surely, no. Because then you imagine if the Avengers game was canon. You know what I mean? Like, that would be, they'd be mad. Like, they're just story driven and live service mostly doesn't go hand in hand. There have been a few games that have booked that trend, but more often they fall by the wayside. They don't manage to get that meat, and it becomes just a churn for mechanics. So I almost think it's a paradox, him saying, yeah, these are going to be important to the overall DC extended universe. I know it's not called that, but you know,
whatever, they don't even know what it is.
You don't even know what it is at this moment. DCU, I think it is just called the Gunverse. But yeah, that to me is paradoxical when you're trying to make these games with high retention and based around a combat loop more than you are a story, if that
I
makes
think
sense.
They'll just take established narrative beats from the movies, the stuff that's ironclad, and then be like, and in between this, they went off and did all this stuff.
Right,
and then they went back, and then they sat down and had the scene again. I think that'll be the way that they'll attempt to split it. But yeah, whatever. I'm fascinated to see how this thing lands. But yeah, that's Suicide Squad February 2nd. Also on February 2nd is Persona 3 Reload, which I don't spend too long on, but it's worth saying that obviously, you know, like Persona fans, Atlas fans, been looking forward to this for a while. It's a weird approach to a remake where they're not including all the extra content that was in Persona 3 Portable. And when they put that game, I think it was on like 3DS or something. I've never actually played Persona 3. I'm a 4 and 5 guy. But I'm curious about this, and I think this is the one I'm going to dive into. It's just the way that they've rolled it out, where they put Persona 3 Portable, which, like I said, is the one with all the extra content on. They made that available on Switch, and they put it back out. I think it was on Xbox as well. And then they also said, we're also remaking Persona 3, and then this is like its own thing. And then, so by getting Persona 3 Reload, which looks to play more like Persona 5, but it doesn't have the extra character stuff, the extra expansion pack stuff that was in the portable version of the original Persona 3. So you're not getting like what could be a definitive edition. You're getting this, like, I don't know, for whatever reason, this trimmed version of it, which is drawn a little bit of ire amongst the Persona fans.
I'm an outsider's perspective on this. You know, Persona is a franchise I've always been intrigued by.
Turn-based, my friend.
Turn-based, put me off. I'm sorry, Emma.
He's loving it.
I'm a normie, what
You've
can I say?
You've turned the corner, maybe now it's your thing.
I like swords. I like being a Ninja Gaiden. Mr. Ninja Gaiden
you
is my
get,
guy.
You get swords in this game.
You can't do it with yourself, though. I want to feel the thrill of it.
You
got to
tell him to
say.
Use the sword, and then he uses the sword.
The point is, I do think it's always poor form when you have a remake or you have a remaster that doesn't include everything and try to be the definitive edition, like you said. You know, I talked up and loved The Last of Us Part 1, but in hindsight, now that Last of Us Factions has been cancelled, I can't believe that the definitive version of that game doesn't come with the multiplayer, because I thought that was such a huge part of the original game. Mm-hmm. And you can, obviously, it's a single player series, it's known for its narrative, but to just eliminate that, that sucks to me.
Yeah, and it's like the way that they're approaching it, where it looks absolutely gorgeous. Like, this would be the assumption would be this is the one to play. So we'll see how that thing shakes out. I might be wrong in regards to how, you know, they could address the extra plot points in a different way or something like that. But the general conversation around it was we'll kind of wait and see how it feels. So that's on February 2nd as well, alongside Suicide Squad. And then a few days later, February 8th is Helldivers 2, a game that Sony just refused to show anyone. There's like bits of gameplay, but there's no hands-on previews.
Yeah,
it's weird.
Ewan is really looking forward to this. I know
he's the only person I know. Like, I don't know, I honestly haven't seen any positive buzz online. No one I know is talking about it. Like, even Sony are just kind of like, yeah, it's kind of there if you want it, we have no idea, it's a sequel to something that's 10 years old,
yeah,
whatever. And then bless little Ewan's like, I can't wait to play it, and I'm like, good on you, mate, I hope it's great. But I just don't even, I don't see anyone caring about this.
I hope it's a Returnal situation. That was similar in that they showed Returnal off a good few times, but I remember even us doing podcasts going, I don't know about this. You're selling it for 70 $50 and it's a new IP and it's a roguelike and it's a shooter and it's from a studio that hasn't done a game of this scale before. Mm. Like, what's it going to be? And then in my opinion, that turned out really well. It was a Game of the Year contender. So that's what I hope is the situation with Hell.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Divers, whether that actually happens, I don't know. I'm not even familiar with the original game, but what I've seen from the second one has got me intrigued way more than the original ever did. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think this is going to be definitely a wait-and-see one for me. I'll let Ewan take the charge in it, and I'll see what his opinions are afterwards.
Yeah, my overall point is just that I think they dropped the ball in the marketing, or convincing you that it's a Sony first-party game, that it's a big deal. Because I think that gameplay-wise, yeah, it kind of looks a bit like Earth Defense Force, like mixed with the original Helldivers, which had like a cool little mechanics where you were sort of doing like fighting game combos to dial in specials, and it's like, I like the idea of what they were going for. I just found it really, really hard, and you needed to play as a squad.
Yeah,
and I was hardly ever in person with enough people to do that properly. But yeah, I imagine Helldivers 2 will capitalize on that more, and it's an over-shoulder third-person shooter, so it should be a bit more approachable. That's on February 8th. Tomb Raider's remasters, Tomb Raider 1, 2, and 3, are coming February 14th. Just throwing this in there as, where are you at on these? I think they're interestingly presented.
Well, this is very personal to me, because I'm always saying, you know, you should bring back all of these old PlayStation era games and make them accessible. What's annoying me is that PlayStation keep doing this after I've put the effort in to track down the original copies and play them on PlayStation. I went and tracked down an old PS1 and a CRT TV, and then I got Star Wars The Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. Now that's just on PlayStation Plus. Right. I went and tracked down the old Tomb Raider games, and now they're just coming remastered. And I think whoever's at Sony is watching my social media and seeing me post about these things. Why are you doing it to me? Give me a heads up before I go spend ludicrous money on secondhand copies. But no, in all seriousness,
it took so long for them to get here, though.
And that's it, yeah. In all seriousness, man, I think, yeah, it's long overdue, but I like that they're here. I want to know, like, what modernizations have you brought to the table? But yeah, for something as iconic as the original Tomb Raider games, just having them available at all on modern hardware is a win, as long as they don't crap the bed like a GTA Definitive Edition, which I can't imagine. It's kind of like the Until Dawn remaster that we talked about on the news video, and I'm glad that it's there.
Well, the thing is with this, I had to Google that just to make sure, but they've said you can hit a button to switch back to classic graphics whenever you want.
Nice.
Which is like the Halo Master Chief Collection, or the anniversary edition of Halo, which I think should be standard in most remasters, let's say. It's just that the look of the Tomb Raider is like, it just looks a bit weird. Mm. But I think there's only so much you can do when your actual like nav mesh of the actual level is already pre-made. And it has, I love the old school Tomb Raiders, but like they're so jagged and cliffs have like, oh, now it's a box coming out of this wall so I can climb on it. And that's great. There's a lot of charm to that, but at the same time, I think it limits some of the visual presentation, and so I'm curious how they're going to sort of sell or be received. I'm just glad that games are available. Like, obviously, there's trophy support, achievement support, so yeah.
Another win for James Dowse. I remember maybe the last time he was on the podcast, he talked about he was either going back to replay them or he wanted to replay them, right. So that's a win for him. Yeah, it's funny, because having gone back to the old Tomb Raider when I got that PlayStation 1, I think it was Tomb Raider 3. I forgot just how piss hard those things are.
Oh, dude,
are.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Man, we as gamers and players do not know how good we have it these days. How did I ever play Tomb Raider when I was like 6? How did I get through it?
We just put up with it because we had nothing else.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like, you have no... What? I remember when Splinter Cell Chaos Theory, like, you save anywhere, and that was mind-blowing.
Yes.
But like, yeah, in Tomb Raider, it was like, do the entire climb or you're like starting again.
Because of that, I'm interested in how they're going to be received from a modern perspective. It's not that they're hard. It's just that they have a lot of those...
They're awkward.
Yeah. They are time-wasty in a lot of ways, and you're doing big chunks of the level over and over again. Maybe not with the save anywhere feature that they've added, of course, but if you wanted to play them in their purest form, you'll be doing that. So yeah, I'm interested to see how they're received in 2024, because I love them, have a lot of nostalgia for them, but I can't imagine, you know, me as 13 now, if I was 13 right now, you know, going to Tomb Raider Remastered and having a fun time, but maybe they're not there for that. I like that they're just, you know, they've been, what would you call it, put in the library. They've allowed to come back and be accessible for people who are interested. And this isn't supposed to be like Grand Theft Auto Remastered or even Crash Remastered, you know what I mean? It's more of a, in my opinion, a curio kind of thing for people who didn't grow up with them.
That's the thing. It feels like an archival thing. It's like these games should be available.
That's the word I was looking for.
It's near enough that. But like still, like, you know, me and you love the Tomb Raider Anniversary game where they remade the original game. And it's like, I love that little trilogy of like the Anniversary one, Legend and Underworld. Yeah. Like the way those games play, to me, is perfect Tomb Raider. I did the 2013 one. I thought like Rise and Shadow got worse. But like there's so many little gameplay tropes that were so identifiable as Tomb Raider tropes that we don't really have anymore. Like the idea of capitalizing on a big 3D space that you're conquering over time. Like it's just really, really cool. And so I wonder if people will latch onto that or whether it will just be too awkward, because the originals have that thing where it's like sidestep, get in the exact line, and if you're not even 1 centimeter off the end of the cliff, you haven't jumped far enough, she won't grab the edge. I assume they've tightened those bits up, but there is something to the playability of those originals that can be off-putting as hell.
It's funny, it's like, it's crazy to think back now, but I remember when they changed the input so you didn't have to jump and then press another button to grab the ledge, and I thought that was sacrilegious. I thought, why would you get rid of that? That's outrageous. And now I think, why was I so caught up with like this one button hang? There was something about the meticulousness though of those original games that they're awkward, they're sometimes very clumsy, especially when you mistime a jump and it's not your fault and you fall into a pit of spikes, but there is something still satisfying about having that level of control and, like you said, conquering that 3D world.
Yeah, man, that's the thing. There's something so satisfying about climbing in games. Like, the early Assassin's Creed used to have that as an actual gameplay mechanic, the idea that each button was an arm, and they didn't really run with it that much. But I'll shout out Jusant that came out last year. That's a phenomenal game that kind of has, like, Death Stranding has a bit of climbing in it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, if you're going to make a parallel, like, Jusant is almost like if you take the climbing aspects of Death Stranding and blow them all the way up, where you're putting pittons in the wall and making ropes and swinging, and, like, Jusant rules.
Speaking me language.
Yeah, Jusant's awesome, and, like, yeah. Yeah, like Tomb Raider can tap into that. These games won't necessarily, that's where that stuff came from, but I hope all of this is indicative of where Tomb Raider's going to go. Because like I said, I love that middle trilogy, and I hope they go back to that.
I've not seen the trailer since it was first announced, so they might have already answered this as well, but what I'm interested in is when they have been remastering these games. I remember, again, going back to the third game on the PlayStation 1, how much the draw distances of those games are a part of it, because you can't see crap until right up close to them. And I wonder whether if they've implemented something similar, like a fog system where you can't see the world, or if they are just giving you access to everything straight away so you can see the exit and enter.
I had a little rinses. Little cheeky Google there, because I didn't know off the top of my head. Apparently, they've not addressed that yet. Looking at some of the hands-on stuff just there, saying that it's lots of fans requesting it, but nothing just yet. But you would make sense. That thing killed the Silent Hill remakes when they were originally remastered. But they're trying to walk a line between letting it feel like the originals and then making it work for a new audience. And I guess I'll just see how that stuff lands. That's on February 14th, which is a fun Valentine's Day release
for
a Tomb Raider game. Super quick, Mario versus Donkey Kong's on February 16th.
What is this?
Well, that's the thing, right? I love, obviously, Nintendo, Mario, Donkey Kong, everything else, and I just don't care about this game. Like, it looks neat enough, but I think because the way that it looks seems like it's all boxed in, it looks like it plays like the original Donkey Kong games when Mario, it wasn't necessarily his debut, but he was called Jumpman back then, and they're trying to do like a modern version of that. Some of this, or a lot of this, to me, feels like a tide over because we're waiting for the Switch 2, and we're waiting for them to show us the next Metroid Prime or whatever it is. There's a whole thing doing the rounds about a Nintendo Direct that apparently has been leaked, and it'll have, you know, various games in there, but they all feel like stopgaps. It's like it's another Fire Emblem, it's another remaster of Metroid Prime, Metroid Prime 2 and 3, things like that. And I feel like 2024 is a stopgap year, because I think because of the pandemic, they had to push production back quite a lot. There was all those rumors across the pandemic of what the next Switch was going to be. And then when that didn't happen, I feel like Nintendo just sort of held back and were just like, well, we might as well put some games out now and whatever. And just the way that this thing looks, I haven't dove into it that much other than just some of the little bits of footage when they first announced it. Feels quite a small scale game, which I don't care about in terms of the production. It's neat, I'll buy it, but I'm not freaking out about it. I'm just including it because it's Mario.
How do you feel about that approach as somebody who plays the Switch more regularly than I, because for me, I'd prefer them to have a stopgap year and then come out swinging with big hitters with the launch of the Nintendo Switch 2. Yeah. But obviously, if you're a fan who maybe only plays Switch games, you can definitely view this as, well, when are the big ones coming, you know? I'm looking forward to the Princess Peach game, by the way.
Yeah, that might be the
that's
only in March.
Switch game that I buy this year, but it definitely feels like they're holding a lot back.
Yeah, Nintendo have a certain scale. Like, so far, they've never done something on a Naughty Dog Rockstar level, and I'd be so curious what that would be. Where would they even put the money? But at the same time, like, I don't mind them doing a stopgap year in terms of as long as the Switch 2 stuff comes out swinging, because it's been a long time. It's like 7 years since the original Switch, which is crazy. But we'll see. I think the Mario vs. Donkey Kong is like an interesting little concept.
Yeah.
That I think a lot of this is just capitalizing on the Mario vs. Donkey Kong scene in the movie. Because even the aesthetic of this, like, obviously, originally back in the 80s, they fought on pylons, which was a reference in the movie. And then now you've got a playable version of that. And you had Nintendo, I forget the name of the specific animator, talking about wanting to get Nintendo game movement to be closer to the movie, because that's what a lot of people now associate as that's how fluid those characters move, and trying to make sure everything moves very. Mario Wonder is a beautiful game, and moves very, very well. It was gorgeously animated, and it feels like, you know, that was a step in that direction.
As you can tell, I was just sneezing off camera. I'm allergic to Nintendo stuff.
Yeah,
yep,
so can't stand it.
Nothing else to comment there. You started talking about a Nintendo movie, and my allergies flared up.
Your brain just shuts down. No, I can't.
He's talking about the Mario movie again.
I'll tell you what will revitalize you, but not at all, is Skull and Bones finally coming out.
God.
February 16th, same day as Mario versus Donkey Kong, as opposed to Skull and Bones versus reality. I'll be amazed if this thing does anything.
What?
I was Googling when this thing started, because we've been with it for quite a while. It started as a Black Flag spin-off in 2013. I remember it being talked about back then.
Yeah.
That's how old I am.
Yeah.
And then following this. And then it was formally announced in 2017. But I remember the idea of a ship-based multiplayer game being mentioned after Black Flag, because there was also ship stuff in Assassin's Creed 3. But yeah, Skull and Bones, February 16th.
We tentatively decided to do a February look forward podcast last week, and I remember bringing Skull and Bones up as one of the big games out in February. And since we had that conversation until right now, I forgot it was coming out in February. Like, that game just, it's like a little bit of solipsism when I'm not thinking about it. It doesn't exist.
Yeah,
I'm sure that's how Ubisoft has approached it over the past 10 years as well. I'm intrigued by this, but at this point, man, we had that great, I think it was a Kotaku one. It was definitely Jason Schreier from a few years ago. I think it was. Now I'm second guessing it. But the point is, they were looking into, you know, why it was made, and it was not cancelled, apparently, because there was a deal with the Singapore government to help fund it to get it over the line. That seems like the only reason that Ubisoft has persisted when they've been cancelling a bunch of other projects for probably fewer reasons. So it's going to be interesting to live in a world where this thing is buyable and you can play it. I hope it's good. I never hope a game fails, but I think if it is just Black Flag spin-off like it was originally intended to be. I'm sure that will please some people, but like that is 10 years overdue.
The thing with this is it kind of works in their favor because Sea of Thieves is obviously is a neat enough analog. Like the development of this game predates Sea of Thieves in terms of being more of a talked about thing. But Sea of Thieves is in a much better place now than it was back at launch. And that game was fine enough at launch, but there's tons of content packs to it and a solid fan base for it and community and everything. And so maybe there's a way of trying to Ubisoftify that general approach. I think those fans already have the game that they're going to keep playing. I doubt they would give up Sea of Thieves, but it just depends how much people love the naval combat of Black Flag, and then obviously it reappeared in Origins and whatever, but I don't know, this just feels like Ubisoft going like, let's segment a thing and sell you it.
Have you seen much marketing for this? Like, do you
know? Well, they did that hands on push.
I saw there was some previews that dropped, but yeah, like in terms of getting it out there, like I don't know if they're confident in this. I imagine they want it to sell after 10 years or whatever, but like I don't know. Is this a Avatar situation where they're kind of just like, oh, we've got this game, you might be all right, you might want to play it, I don't know, we're not going to try and convince you.
No, I feel like, I haven't seen much marketing for it, not much positive stuff. There was the hands-on beta thing where they showed all the monetization side of it and all the each individual piece of your ship that you're customizing can be bought as far as it looks anyway. They might have changed that now. But this long in development, if you're them, if it was a contractual obligation to get it finished, if it's some sort of government grant in the first place, all that money's already changed hands. So like in regards to obviously the extended development, you might as well monetize the living F out of it and try and get and see how that goes, because it's kind of a lost cause anyway. And I imagine that their top brass is just saying hit the monetization button and see what we can do with this.
I know everything points against it, but I would love to live in a world where Skull and Bones is a Game of the Year contender. Imagine that. Things would be looking up for humanity.
Odd, if this knocks Tekken 8 off the top,
exactly,
then I might just be done with video games. But at least I'd be happy about it. Apparently it's just accepting that reality. A few days later on February 22nd is Open Roads, which I just wanted to throw in because it's a really cool looking narrative game starring Kerry Russell and Caitlin Dever, who Caitlin Dever's recently been confirmed as Abby in The Last of Us Season 2. But yeah, we don't know much about this game other than it's a mother-daughter road trip game. It just looks really cool, and I'm just shouting that out. It's just something that people who like the likes of Gone Home or narrative forward games, they were all the rage 10 years ago.
They were. And then I
still love them myself, but you don't get that many of them anymore, and it's worth just shouting that out.
I love both of those people, by the way. I know obviously Caitlin Dever's back in the news because of the Abby casting. She's been great and stuff, but I love Kerry Russell as well. I know her only really from The Americans, but she is incredible across that series. Like, instantly became one of my favorite actors. And then when she was announced for Star Wars Rise of Skywalker,
that's all I know her for.
She was underused in and didn't show off her talents. Like, I think she was just up for an Emmy for another show that I haven't seen. But yeah, she's great. Caitlin Dever's great. I'm excited to see their performances in this game.
Give me an acting powerhouse narrative forward game. You wanted to throw in a Pacific Drive also on the same day, February 22nd.
Two like road-based driving games,
which is why they're both together.
I'm gonna not spend too much time on this because it's a smaller game in scope, but I just like the idea of this kind of horror supernatural infused road trip survival game where you're constantly having to maintain your car, like your car is your world in the game.
Oh, I know what you mean.
And I liked that mechanic in Days Gone. I thought the way you had to like look after your bike in that game and constantly keep on top of it, keep adding modifications to it, repair it, make it an extension of your character worked really well. And I'm not even a car guy. Normally, I don't like car combat or anything like that in games. The one exception is Mad Max or Carmageddon on the PlayStation 1. But I like the idea of having a big sort of like mechanical beast that you have to look at that is literally your safe space from this violent world, and you have to keep on top of it and you have to look after it. There's something about the satisfaction of that that I am really intrigued by. So and then you throw on the horror elements on top. So I'm interested in that, how those things, those elements intertwine.
Yeah, man, I forgot that's what this game was. I think in my head, because they're so similar in the idea of a road trip-based game or car-based game, that I kind of did cross it over with Open Roads quite a bit. But yeah, if anyone hasn't seen the footage for Pacific Drive, it does look really promising. A week after, Star Wars Dark Forces Remaster is out on February 28th, which I don't know if you're going to get this.
Never played Dark Forces.
I did, but I was so young. Like, I have such a soft spot for the old-school Star Wars games, like X-Wing versus versus TIE Fighter. Like, I'm going back so much. But I used to love those old games on PC. And the first series of those first-person shooter games that were made on the Quake engine, I played them before I played Quake. So I was too young, but like I just there's a feel to those games, and it's why I still love playing through the original Doom. There's like a kind of like a floatiness to the, and like a head bob, and you're just taking dudes out. There's a flow to those games that I love. And I grew up on that stuff. I obviously went into Quake and Unreal Tournament and everything else. And so I'm just looking forward to playing something like that. Because it was a few years ago, but they brought back Jedi Academy.
Yeah.
And the, what are the other ones called as well? But obviously you can go first person in them. And that was kind of like a, eventually that series became those ones. And so I just like, it's the same thing with Tomb Raider. It's just cool to have these games be available.
No, I agree. Like, it's cool to have it back. I like that you have that canon of Star Wars games now. Like, I was, you know, joking about it earlier, but I genuinely love that Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace from the PlayStation 1 is now readily available. I hope Sony does more of that going forward. The game rules, man, and I have a lot of nostalgia for it. I was too young for Dark Forces. It was a little bit before my time, so I jumped on that series with Star Wars Jedi Knight 2.
Jedi Power Battles is what I was going to say.
Well,
yes.
In that series in particular, it was Jedi Knight 2 with Kyle Katarn, where you first get the lightsaber, I think. No, yeah, the one before you might get the lightsaber as well. But yeah, my first Star Wars games were Jedi Power Battles and The Phantom Menace. So one, I want to see Power Battles come back. But two, the point I'm trying to make is I never got into the more first-person Quake-style Star Wars games because I never got into Jedi 2 because of that first stint before you get the lightsaber, and it is more or less just like a Quake or a Doom level. I've tried to get into that game like 5 times. Everyone holds it up as one of like the best Star Wars games ever made, and I just struggle with it for whatever reason. So I imagine I'll also struggle with Dark Forces, which sounds even more indebted to that older, more labyrinthine first-person shooter style of gameplay. But still, it might not be for me, but I love that it's there.
The level design is the thing that makes me put them down again, because it's just, that's the thing that I think has aged them the most. Like, I can argue the it's a style in terms of, like, I'm not worried about reloading. I'm not aiming down the sights. I'm just wiping dudes out, and there's loads of canned animations happening as they fly everywhere. I just love the feel of those games. But it is the level design after a while where it's like, you need the blue key card, and that's somewhere in this maze, and it's like, oh my God. So yeah, that's on the, February 28th. The day after, which is probably the one game out of all of these that most people are going to be getting, is Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. That's out on February 29th. Only on PlayStation 5, though.
Outrageous. We talked about this briefly in the State of Play video that we just did, but yep, up for it. I like that that's essentially going to be my next big game, you know, coming off Baldur's Gate 3. Dabble in some smaller titles, maybe like Tekken 8 or Mortal Kombat 1, finally get to that.
Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, my friend?
That's too big. It's too big. Why do they keep releasing those Like a Dragon games alongside other things?
Yeah.
Like, when I'm coming off a big game, I just want them to find the perfect release schedule for that. But no, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, yeah, I think, I don't even know what else to say about that at this point. I'm looking forward to it. I've kept away from most of the gameplay trailers, to be honest, so everything's going to be a surprise. I don't know anything about this part of the story from the original game, actually.
Right.
Like, I didn't know much about the first, but I at least kind of knew some basic beats of, you know, the initial set
bombing
piece,
run.
The bombing run, and, you know, some of the characters and Midgar itself, whereas now I have no idea where we are. I have no idea what's going on. I have no idea what the end game is. It's really a blank slate for me, even more so than the first one.
Yeah, this is the bit in the original where, like, you would switch discs, and then it was like everything was open-ended and go to the world map and everything. It was like, back then, it was like, oh my God, how was them all game? And then we went on for another 70-odd hours. I mean, I love how big this looks. I never really thought they would do the whole recreate the world thing, because the original game's world map is an entire world map. Like, you have different continents and everything. So to get that size across, like, I know they've said it's across multiple discs, but I think it's more of a throwback thing to just how it was on the PS1 one. I'm curious how big the world map feels and whether it does actually feel like a world. Mm. And it feels like you can go to the west or the east and different places that are iconic locations that are from the original. I've said it loads. I'll not go into it loads again, but it's the story stuff that I'm there for. I'm curious, because they've talked loads about walking that line between people who are playing through, like you, who don't know the original, and then everybody who is returning, who knows the way the story's supposed to go and knows what's supposed to happen. And they're already playing with that. Like, they already were at the end of the 2021. So I've always said, in regards to this remake project, that I'm just going to hang back and I'll just view the whole thing holistically. I'm on board. I'm up for the ride. Like, we've got one more game after this as well. So I'll look back and I'll see how it all is when when we get to the end of it. But I'm trusting, because it's a lot of the original devs and original writers and everything that are doing this, that they know what they're doing.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Before we wrap up, as someone who enjoyed Final Fantasy VII Remake but didn't touch Final Fantasy VII Integrate.
Oh yeah.
Should I play Integrate before going into this game? Because I know they have been touting this as a jumping on point if you even wanted to come in fresh and not play the original remake. How important is Integrate to what's coming up? Or can I just watch a YouTube video ask you?
I mean, it's worth playing. Like, it's cool. Really fun. You play as Yuffie. There's a side character in there that you do lots of combos with. Basically, in Integrate, they debut the tandem moves that are all over this thing. Where you're seeing, like, in Rebirth, you're seeing, like, Cloud and Aerith do a combo. Multiple characters can do combos at the same time. They bring that in and Integrate. Integrate's worth playing anyway, because it just plays really well. But it's, like, they have some bosses in there that are from, like, Dirge of Cerberus, or, like, the wider stuff from the original 10th year anniversary, when they originally blew everything out. And they bring two characters back in. And that wider 10-year stuff is what I'm the weakest on. Right. Like, those games weren't great. Like, I played Dirge of Cerberus, I played all that stuff, Advent Children, all, you know, every little bit of media that came with that. That's what they, and they've said they're doing this overall. They're trying to make this one unified thing now. And so if you want the full picture, then yes.
So all that stuff, it was canon before, but is it canon to the remake now as well?
Well, that's, yeah. Oh, like, cool. But it depends what they do with it. It's just that they bring in this whole, there's a whole thing where, like, I'm not going to do spoilers, but it's like, you know, Soldier, capital letter,
yes,
Soldier.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That was like, within Shinra, like, Shinra's the evil company, they were making soldiers.
It was so confusing that, by the way, not having any reference to being like, is this Soldier with a capital? Is it a noun, or is it a general descriptor?
Welcome to 1997 Final Fantasy discourse, where it's just sort of like, yeah, like the idea of Soldier. The wider universe said, what if there were more projects like that? And so some of that might matter. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, like, that's the wider canon, and they invoke that in Integrate. So it's like, I don't know where we're going, which is the thing.
I am dreading and also really looking forward to the inevitable 2-hour podcast we do when this game launches and we've finished it. I'm going to need to draft old Benji Richardson back in day, because he's going to have to be the moderator between us two, as someone who hasn't played this game and someone who is so in on it that you'll know every potential deviation or anything they might missed the boat on, because I'm going to be so out of my depth.
Well, I did back in, it would have been 2020, I did like a 45-minute, because the thing is, with Final Fantasy VII Remake, 2020's one, I finished that at like 4 in the morning, because we had the early access code to it, and I knew the review embargo was the whatever the day was. So I stayed up till 4 in the morning, I recorded that review thing, and then I did a big spoiler video that was like half an hour long, and I was in the mindset for it, I was living it, and I knew everything about everything, and I could do that. I am not that person anymore.
No.
Like, I have checked out.
That was,
like,
the most insane thing you've ever done. If you ever want to know Scott Telford's dedication, I would never do that. I don't have the drive in me to.
I don't know if that's what it is. I don't know if it's drive. I did not feel able to just go to bed, to be honest.
But. I remember you strolling into work that day, practically having just fallen out of bed, wired from the night before, having just hammered this game for like
it was
one
just
and
a week
half
solid,
weeks.
Yeah.
yeah, just nonstop, and being like, I guess I'm doing the video now.
Yeah, well, I would always rather just get my thoughts down. Yeah, that review is being filmed, or was being filmed at like 10 in the morning, 9 in the morning after the 4 a.m. finish. I think I said that in the video itself. My point is that there's going to be a lot of wider stuff to talk about, and they're only going to double down on the wider conversations that fans have been having for 20 plus years now. And I can mostly keep up. It's just that if we're talking about the Sviets, then I'm a little bit out of there. But 7 people are going to know what I'm talking about anyway.
I don't know what that means, but Sviets. Do you reckon, I know we said we weren't going to talk too much about this, but then we found a new avenue that we haven't discussed before. Do you reckon with this one, I know they obviously need to address what happened at the end of Remake, and they obviously have some huge changes to characters that they're carrying through, but do you think they're going to be as mad with the story this time around? Because I like that. That's what got me in. That's what made Final Fantasy VII so Remake, the way that game wraps up. But do you think they might take a step back from that and try to be more appealing to those long-term fans who kind of want a more standard remake?
No, I think they're too far gone.
Yes.
I think they're way too far gone. You've already had the set, like, we already had the Sephiroth final fight at the end of what is meant to be the opening section of the game. Like, in the trailers for Rebirth, they've showed that you're fighting Sephiroth again.
Yeah.
So it's like, I guess you just fight him again and fight him again in the third game. Like, yeah. I don't know what we're doing with this. But no, I think they're too far gone. You can't do a traditional Final Fantasy VII remake anymore. They've got Zack everywhere. You can't do this. Like, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Honestly, that's music to my ears. I don't want a traditional one. I can go back and play a 7 in various different forms at this point. I want to see what more madness they have concocted.
Well, that's the thing. And I treasure, because I loved it back in 2020 and all the conversations that we've had. I love the intersection of newcomer and veteran. Like, someone who knows the original story, someone who's new to it. I just love those conversations. And I hope, I mean, you pretty much know that that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
The way that they've told this story, it is very Kingdom Hearts and it's very out there by the end of the 2021. But it is interesting noting that Tetsuya Nomura isn't the director anymore. It's Yoshinori Kitase, I think. I think it's him, who was like a scenario director or something on the original. But my point is that potentially the Nomura-isms of the dominate Kingdom Hearts, like the way that story's told. And it's an easy like shorthand for like, we're fracturing reality, are we? Oh, there's five of us now, or whatever. Like, that stuff assumedly would take a backseat, but because you've done that, you can't then just pretend that all that stuff didn't happen in 2020. So I don't even know,
It's peculiar, because I could never mess with that stuff when it came to Kingdom Hearts. That was way too impenetrable for me. I remember just trying to play the original games on PlayStation, and they weren't for me gameplay-wise anyway, but just couldn't get into it. And then I really tried to get into Kingdom Hearts 3, but not having any prior knowledge, that thing blagged my head in a major, major way, and I never even finished that game. So I always found it strange how I could never enjoy those Nomura-isms in that franchise, but for some reason, the balance was a little bit better in Final Fantasy VII for my taste.
No, it is.
In terms of giving you like those grounded characters and then giving you some mad stuff, but not in a way where it became like, what is going on?
It's more at the end of 2027 remake where they go just full ham sandwich, whatever, banana sandwich with it. Because they're just like, it's because obviously they're all the, I'm gonna do spoilers for, it's the end of the podcast.
It's the end of the podcast.
I'm doing spoilers for Final Fantasy VII remake in 2020. The whispers were obviously the manifestation of the way the story was supposed to go, and the manifestation of fan expectation, etc. Great stuff, genius stuff, love it. But then you had that stupid thing where like Barrett got stabbed by Sephiroth, and then it was like, well, that's not how it's supposed to go. So he was just fine. And it was like, that's your, like, you can do it on the nose, but like, I don't know how many more things they do like that. Because it was more subtle when Aerith almost falls off inside her own church and one of the whispers puts her back on the ledge.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's great. That's a great, and at the beginning I started figuring out what they're doing with that. That's cool. But that whole thing at the end of remake where there's like a whisper tornado. Can people see that? Because there's devastation that comes from it. And then like all of the gang get thrown into the sky, and then we fight like time itself. And then there was that whole thing where if you cast scan on the enemies, they're revealed as like, oh my God, it's like Verity, Rubrum, and someone else. And they like their weapons line up with the Sons of Sephiroth from Advent Children.
Okay.
I'm getting into the theory video back then. But they're teasing this whole thing where like the new story is like fracturing everything, and then we're trying to like bring it all back together again. But I just, that whole thing with the whispers and the expectation, that was a cute little thing that when one of them pushed Aerith back on the ledge, that they then just detonated Oppenheimer style at the end of that game. It was like, everything had exploded now. Zack's over here now. Like, what?
See, I know I've said it before. That's what I love, man. It reminded me.
But it's multiverse stuff.
It is, but that doesn't inherently mean it's bad. Oh. I'm as over multiverse stuff as everyone else, but I still loved the most recent Spider-Verse film. I thought they managed to nail it. There are things that do multiverse well. I'm not off it as a concept, put it that way. Mm-hmm. And it gave me the same feeling, even though I didn't have the reference points for most of the plot beats in Final Fantasy VII, as, this might not work for you, I don't think you've even seen the show, but there's a bit in Fleabag, right, where the main character, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, I'm going to spoil it for you, is that okay?
Phoebe Waller-Bridge, carry on.
She's always looking at the camera, like breaking the fourth wall, and it just feels like a sort of creative flourish that isn't canon, you know, it's just like, oh, it's just, that's what they do. Mm. But then in season two, they address it in their, like, the characters are like, who you're talking to, you know, like, what's going on. They address it in universe. And it gave me that same feeling in Final Fantasy VII Remake, where initially I was like, okay, this is cute. This is a creative flourish. Mm. But then when they did something consequential with it, that's when I was in. That's when I couldn't stop thinking about the story in a way that I I might not have otherwise.
I think it's just the questions that came from that. Like, yeah, they're fascinating. It's just, and no one's ever done this before. Like, the thing is, there's only been one Final Fantasy VII. It was game-changing. It was industry-changing. Like, you know, it was, it completely revolutionized the idea of what a turn-based game can be in the West. And it was just such a huge deal. It's never been remade before. They teased it 10 years ago. They're finally doing it now. And if you're going to do it, and, you know, I mean, I remember the whole, there's all the interviews with Nojima and all the various staff that have been part of it, saying that, you know, we're getting too old, and if we're going to do it, we need to do it now, because it's going to take like 10, 15 years, 20 years. And so I'm embarking on that journey. And they keep referring to it as like the unknown journey continues and whatever. And I think I don't think they knew what it was going to be. I think that's why they focus so much on Midgar. And so let's just lock that down. That's why I think it goes nuts after Midgar, because that's, they can do those cutscenes later. And it's all cutscene. You don't play anything after that final bit on the road. So it's like, you can tag that all on. Another thing that's in Integre, when you mentioned that 10 years ago, is that they do show more of what's happening after, with the gang on the road and stuff. So, I'm fascinated by it. I don't think I trust it, but I am on board with it. It's a roller coaster. It has one track, and we're just going forward. Like, we're gonna, if that's gonna go off, if there's no track there, we'll fall off.
I don't normally like roller coasters, but I'm on this one. And yeah. I'm enjoying it, but I also feel like I'm gonna be sick at some point. It's funny, man. Like, at the start of this entry, we were like, I don't know what else we have to say about Final Fantasy, and then we've extended this podcast so much that I'm worried that we're going over Adam Wilbourn's time.
You're not wrong. It is time for us to leave the studio. It's also been the Wind Up Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. Enjoy February, and we'll catch you very soon.
See you later.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.